This is a Passover special from HeritageRadioNetwork.org and the Forward newspaper.
This is Leah Eden, Director of Research and Communications at HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
This is Deborah First, Food Editor of the Forward newspaper. You can find us at forward.com.
This is the time of year when your local grocery store becomes inundated with matzahs, macaroons, and Manischewitz gefilte fish. That's right, Passover is right around the corner. Soon, Jews in Orthodox Brooklyn, secular Tel Aviv, small towns in South America, and even rural China will get together with family and friends for the Passover Seder. The Passover Seder is a ritual feast that marks the beginning of a week-long holiday. Families get together to retell the ancient story of the liberation of the Jewish people from generations of Egyptian slavery. In Hebrew, the word Seder means order, the order in which we tell the story and the order in which we eat the meal. People tell the tale of the Exodus from Egypt not just through words, but also through the symbolic foods we eat.
The most well-known Passover food is matzah. It's a flat, brittle, unleavened bread. We eat it not because it's delicious, but to remember that the Jewish slaves didn't have time to let their bread rise before fleeing Egypt. Next to the stack of matzah on the table, you will always see the Passover Seder plate. The Seder plate is filled with six special foods that are used to retell the Exodus story. Maror, a bitter herb such as horseradish, zeroa, a lamb shank, betzah, a roasted egg, charoset, a sweet paste of fruit and nuts, karpas, a green vegetable, chazeret, represented by a bowl of salt water. These items are symbolic of the turmoil that the Jewish slaves went through, and as you eat each one, you are supposed to experience the story as though you were there. In the past few years, some Jews have added different things to the Seder plate to further personalize the story and facilitate timely conversation. Some add fair trade cocoa beans or a tomato as a reminder of workers' plight, a symbol of contemporary slavery. An olive represents hope for the Middle East. An orange or a chunk of bread symbolize the exclusion of women and homosexuals from parts of the Jewish community. While these are the most common known interpretations of the traditional ideas, different communities around the world have adapted them to what's available locally and meaningful to them.
So year after year, the Passover story is retold and experienced through the foods on the Seder plate. But the reality is that Passover food is traditionally not all that fun. During the week of Passover, Jews are forbidden to eat chametz, any leavened foods. Simply, this means I can't eat bread. But I also can't eat anything made with wheat, barley, oats, spelts, or rye. Jews of Eastern European descent, like myself, also do not eat rice, beans, corn, soy, peas, the list goes on and on. Without these staples of cooking, Passover food tends to get a bad rap. We complain about what we can't eat and groan over what we can. But there's no reason that Passover food has to be boring or bland.
What's on your Seder plate? Devra and Leah spoke to people that are reimagining Passover food in new and interesting ways.
Hi, my name is Aaron Israel. I'm a chef here in New York. And I love Jewish food. I've cooked Jewish food in some of the restaurants I've worked in. And I was asked to cook a Seder for the James Beard Foundation. And each dish on the... during the meal was based off of an item on the Seder plate. So one of the dishes, for instance, was based around an egg. And the egg can have multiple symbolisms, depending on, you know, who you ask. If you put two Jews in a room, you generally get four opinions. But one of the interpretations is that, you know, symbol of life and fertility. And so we wanted to pair that idea of renewal and fertility with spring, because it's sort of the time of year where things are being renewed. The eggs sort of become almost sort of marbled, like a sea egg, because the onion skins make the liquid very dark. And then wherever the egg sort of cracks, you get that sort of sea egg marbling texture effect. What we were trying to do is make a classic combination of asparagus and egg, but make the egg a sort of more Jewish version of an egg. So instead of doing, say, like a 6-minute egg or a 7-minute egg, as a lot of people do nowadays, what we decided to do is cook it for 7 or 8 hours, the same way that an egg would be cooked in chon. And there's actually a precedent for it in Sephardic food. Instead of Sephardic Jews don't have chon, they have hamin, which is essentially the same thing, but the Bardic version. And when you have hameen, you often put an egg into it. So the egg ends up cooking for a long time, and the actual, like, the yolk sort of starts to break down again and become, like, really creamy and delicious. So instead of cooking it in the hameen, cooked it with onion skins, which add the dark color and ends up making it look like a tea egg, almost like if you've ever had a tea egg in, like, a Japanese restaurant or something like that.
One item that will likely show up at most Passover meals is gefilte fish. You'd be surprised about some of the innovative ways that people are making gefilte fish these days.
Perhaps never in the history of gefilte fish has the Hamish dish received so much attention. A panel at the Center for Jewish History in New York last fall brought together gefilte experts from the Second Avenue Deli, Kutcher's Tribeca, the Beard Foundation, and the Gefilteria team. No matter if the audience loved it or hated it, everybody seemed to have an opinion, and a strong one at that. Today we're joined by Jeffrey Askowitz, the chief pickler and co-owner of the Gefilteria, a New York-based gefilte fish company. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Glad you're here. So tell us exactly, what is gefilte fish? What makes gefilte gefilte?
What makes gefilte gefilte? I love that question. Gefilte actually means stuffed, right? So it gefilte fish would mean stuffed fish. What it actually is really the stuffing of the fish. No, rarely is it served in the actual fish carcass, which is traditionally how it used to be served. So we're basically eating ground fish stuffing in a ball or loaf form, which sounds incredibly unappetizing. I'm going to take it a step from there, and essentially, if we want to really take it into a food context, but we're eating a fish tureen in some way. So that's at least how we present ours. Others would make them more like a fish. People compare it to a poached fish ball or a quenelle, you know, in the French tradition. And so there's those are different ways that you can try to understand what this thing is, but it's just a Jewish fish appetizing tradition.
For more observant Jews, it's definitely sort of a hallmark of a Shabbat dinner, but I think for Jews for whom Jewish meals are maybe less frequent, it's really most often associated with Passover. Is there any particular connection historically between gefilte fish and Passover?
There's a few things that definitely work very nicely with Passover. One is horseradish. Gefilte fish and horseradish are meant to be together. The flavors, the horseradish brings them together, one and the same. But horseradish, it's a springtime root. It's when it's freshest, it's best. And of course, we put the horseradish, the maror, on the Seder plate, and it's that bitterness is built into the holiday. And that's one of the main reasons I like to think that gefilte fish and Passover go hand in hand.
So let's go back a little bit. I want to hear, how did you guys decide to go into the gefilte fish business? Did you always love gefilte fish, or was it something you came to later in life?
I always loved gefilte fish. I was blessed to grow up with fresh gefilte fish made by my grandmother. And then even when she stopped making gefilte fish, I was blessed with stores around me in suburban New Jersey that delis or Jewish shops, like a place called Zeta's that no longer exists, that would make traditional gefilte fish. One of my business partners, Liz, grew up eating jarred gefilte fish, and so she hated it. She couldn't stand the stuff. I mean, really, it started as this crazy idea. Let's make gefilte fish relevant again, and let's take it outside of the jar, and let's make people feel good about it and not embarrassed about a jarred, gross, gray, gelatinous thing. Kind of upping the game, upping the gefilte ante.
So for the listeners who have never seen or maybe tried your gefilte fish, can you describe it a little bit? Because I think it's about as far on the spectrum away from gray jarred gefilte fish as is humanly possible.
First of all, ours doesn't come in balls, doesn't come in log. It comes in a loaf form. We bake ours. We bake it. We use a lot of onions and a lot of. We actually use an onion broth, in the baking process. So it's basically essentially baking a loaf in an onion broth. We use a few different kinds of fish. We don't use carp. Carp is one of the staples of gefilte fish. Many people know the story of the carp in the bathtub. Carp as a fish, especially carp from the Great Lakes, which is it's a bottom feeding fish. It's dirty. That grayness that people associate with gefilte fish is often from the carp. It's on sustainability guides. Carp is really, it's low. It's not a great fish. And so we wanted to focus on sourcing really high quality fish, sustainably sourced fish. We're using whitefish and pike from the Great Lakes, which are both on the sustainable seafood guides, you know, good choices. We're using salmon, and we're using, and now for this Passover, we're starting to use a steelhead trout as well. And those are for, we basically have a two-tone gefilte fish. So it's a pink layer and a white layer. It's beautiful. It's meant to have those sharp lines. It's not, you know, ours is also a little bit denser than some other gefilte fishes because we don't use filler, we don't use breadcrumbs, we don't use matz meal or potato starch, which makes ours gluten-free and makes it more densely packed with fish. So each bite, you're getting a little bit more of that quality stuff, which is a little bit of a straying from our peasant roots, but we kind of feel like we're at this time that we can really celebrate the quality of the fish that in some ways our ancestors would have loved to have been able to do, but could not.
So one of the things that I think has been most interesting in this interest in Jewish food in the broader food community is that there's been a really intense focus on gefilte fish. There's been jokes and speculations that if gefilte fish can, for lack of a better term, kind of go gourmet, so can all of Jewish cuisine. New York Magazine even ran an article called "Haute Gefilte Fish, Can Jewish Food Go Upscale?" What do you make of that? Should gefilte fish be something that can go upscale? Is it in some ways representative of the challenges of elevating Jewish cuisine? What's its role in that almost gentrification of Jewish food?
I love that, the gentrification of gefilte. Yeah, and so some people are holding it as the litmus test for how far Jewish food can go. How upscale can it go? You know, for us, we don't. You know, we're not a restaurant, right? We're not opening up a fine dining establishment and serving gefilte fish as the appetizer. And some have done that. Kutcher's Tribeca, they've dressed it up. It looks beautiful. They put microgreens on top of the gefilte, and they're using a wild halibut. And you know, for us, we've wanted to really stick as close as we can to the essence of what gefilte fish is, while, you know, taking a cue in some ways from the Alice Waterses of the world, right? So taking a cue from people who are exploring their peasant origins and peasant roots, and just elevating the ingredients and what's going into it. So for, you know, us, using sustainably sourced fish, using really fresh fish, you know, serving it fresh or blast freezing it so it, you know, the frozen fish will capture that freshness. So, you know, doing that to make sure that people are getting as close to what they, you know, their ancestors would have aspired to. I mean, there's a reason that they were, you know, keeping carps in the bathtub up until the holidays, because they wanted the freshest quality fish. And so for us, that's kind of in some ways what we see we're doing. Somehow we've have, in the Jewish food world, people really want everything to stay the same. People always want, oh, that's not how my grandmother made it. That's not how my Bubby or Zadie made it. And you know, I think that we don't know where this will go, because there will be some, hopefully, some experimenting and some exploring. And I think we're at the beginning of this Jewish food renaissance, and hopefully, you know, at least.
I'm hoping that it'll be eaten in all sorts of different types of households.
That's the dream. We want the hipsters and the Hasids to come together over gefilte fish.
Some symbolic Seder plate items are even being reimagined into drinks.
I'm Rob Corwin, and along with my husband Danny Jacobs, I'm one of the creators of the Sipping Seder, which is a project that sort of a creative reimagining of the items on the traditional Seder plate as, you know, oddly enough, a list of classically inspired cocktails. The one that was really sort of a sticking point for us in the long term was the Zeroa, the lamb shank bone on the plate, and as you can imagine, creating a cocktail around a lamb shank bone was not a sort of easy challenge to tackle. And to do it, we really wound up after a while sort of getting into the meaning of the symbol and saying, what does this bone really represent? And looking into the idea that it represented the Paschal lamb, the lamb that was sacrificed in the temple at Passover. And sort of, you know, getting away from the bone back to the origin of the symbol, we said, let's look at the sacrificial lamb. And what we decided to do was to create a cocktail that was
representing the sacrificial lamb, not through the bone, but through the blood of the lamb. And so what we did was to create a cocktail that has the sort of color and consistency, as odd as that may sound, of the lamb's blood. 2 ounces of bourbon mixed in equal parts with ruby port, and a little bit of gum syrup, which is basically sugar syrup with a bit of gum arabic as a thickener, some lemon juice, and a little bit of maraschino liqueur. And those are shaken up pretty vigorously with ice and then strained into a cocktail glass. And the result is sort of a slightly viscous, very dark red cocktail with a little tiny bit of sort of foam coming to the edge of the glass. And part of the process of developing the sipping seder was actually, which is an unexpected, you know, side benefit, was it really drove us to dive deeper into our own Jewish heritage to explore these symbols and their meanings more in order to find ways to create cocktails that represented them. And, you know, in doing that, we got a lot more exposure to some of these ideas of, you know, one, there's this idea of taking the tradition and making it relevant to new generations and then allowing it to evolve, to stay real and not become something staid and dusty that fades into the distant past. There's some great things that people are doing about trying to take the Seder itself and make it more relevant and modern. And we're actually, one of our cocktails, the Hazeret, uses a twist of orange peel, which is actually with our way of bringing in, you know, we really like this idea of people putting the orange on the Seder plate to represent, you know, acceptance for gay and lesbian and transgendered folks. And we wanted to bring that in. So that was a subtle nod of, we actually, you know, we brought the orange into the sipping seder as well, because a lot of the folks that we know here in San Francisco include the orange. And certainly, you know, that, you know, we've been hearing more and more about other symbols that are sort of emerging, and I think it would be fun to explore those as well.
One person who really knows how to host a Passover dinner is Mitchell Davis, Vice President of the James Beard Foundation and host of Taste Matters on heritageradionetwork.org.
I'm here speaking with Mitchell Davis, Vice President of the James Beard Foundation and host of Taste Matters on our very own network. He is also the originator of the James Beard House Passover Seder. So welcome.
Maybe I'm the originator of the Seder in general.
Just in general?
No, but I'm not that old.
I feel like that was a little before your time,
yes,
perhaps. Just
a
little.
That's true. But maybe I've made the most fun one, although that's not even true. There are some amazing Seders out there. But yeah, about 3 years ago, we did, when the James Beard Foundation did this great pop-up restaurant for 5 weeks in Chelsea Market, it happened to coincide with Passover, overlap with Passover, and normally we wouldn't do anything at the Beard Foundation. We don't generally book things on Jewish holidays, which surprises people sometimes from outside New York that they're so important and people don't come to things, but this is New York City after all. And although we had done Passover events not on the first or second night because they were Seder nights, in the past at the Beard House, I just became obsessed with this idea that we had communal tables, we had a beautiful space, and we needed to do a cool Seder on the second night. So we left the first night for families and the second night for fun. And that was, as you said, it was about 3 years ago, and it just was this huge success. And we've done one at the Beard House on the second night ever since.
So why do you think it was such a big success from the very beginning?
Well, partly, obviously, holidays are about more than just the food, but I think that especially the Jewish holidays that have two nights associated with them, I feel like one night you feel obligated to the family thing, and the other night you are sometimes looking for something else. And we were concerned the food isn't kosher. We didn't say it was going to be kosher. Obviously, we're not serving a pork roast or something like that. But we just felt that people might want to be looking for something to do with an elevated food experience and sharing in a different way for the holiday. And it was a feeling we had. There actually was a great article last week on Shabbat dinners that people are doing, sort of Brooklyn hipsters or whatever, and there's a Southern Shabbat dinner happening at City Grit. And I just think that there's this idea of kitchen Judaism, or the cultural aspect, the culinary cultural aspect of Judaism, is more pervasive than people even thought. And we're in the midst of a resurgence of interest in the Jewish food as well as the cultural aspects. And I just think people were looking for a place to have fun. And because of the setup of the Beard Foundation, which are large communal tables, you can bring a lot of people, you can bring your in-laws or your children or whatever, and just have a different experience for the holiday.
Right. And I think I'm especially interested in that idea of the resurgence of kind of gourmet Jewish food, especially around Passover.
Yeah.
Because Passover gets such a bad rap. You know, people either focus on what you can eat, the lack of bread, or just
right.
just kind of a lack of excitement around Passover in general in terms of food.
So true. And so many of the Passover things, you know, Jewish food, Ashkenazi Jewish food, let's say, has been maligned to begin with. And then when you take away flour and other things, forget it.
It just goes downhill, right?
If you grew up on the Manischewitz matzah ball mix and those macaroons in a can, not that they don't hold a place of nostalgia for you, but they're not good. And most of that food is crap. And so, I'm an avid believer. I wrote a Jewish cookbook called The Ment Chef, and the subtitle was Because Delicious Jewish Food Isn't an Oxymoron. And I think that's true. Like, we just think it's going to be bad and we don't try to make it good. And the reality is that even with the limitations of Passover, you can make delicious food.
Right. So tell us a little bit about that delicious food that one will expect this coming Passover. You know, it is at the James Beard House, kind of the center of deliciousness. I can imagine you're not going to have Manischewitz in the boxed.
No, I hope we don't have that, although there may be some just for the iconography of it. The menu sort of straddles traditional and non-traditional things, and I'm making the matzo ball soup, and it will be as traditional as can be, but the best matzo balls anyone's ever had, I guarantee you. They're floaters,
by the
way.
Are you the fluffy kind?
Fluffy.
Okay, good.
Fluffy, big,
thank
delicious.
Goodness.
Yeah, no. I did, in testing the recipe for my book, I actually wanted to have a recipe for floaters and one for sinkers, and I once made a matzo ball, my friends will never forget, that was so tough, you couldn't cut it with a knife. Actually, they would bounce out of the bowl. We just were dying laughing. Anyway, no,
these
are floaters.
Some people would love that.
They're artisanal, let's say. I render the schmaltz. We grind the matzah, all that sort of stuff. But then on the other hand, we invited Noah Bernamoff and Ray, his wife and partner, from Mile End. And they're going a little bit more, I don't know, can we say elevated? They're doing, with allusions to the holiday, their dish is charred bitter herbs with seared Schooner Bay salmon, pickled belly locks, beet, apple, and mustard seed. It is not going to be something that you would have seen on a traditional Seder table, but the charred bitter herb, which I think is awesome, referring to the bitter herb on the Seder plate, and part of the service. And also, pickled belly locks is sort of a deli classic. My mother used to serve that alongside herring and smoked salmon and stuff like that. And I think the playfulness with the things that resonate with our nostalgia for the flavors and the traditions of Judaism are part of what's going to make it really fun and delicious for everybody.
Right. No, I think the nostalgia part is really important because, you know, as a guest at a Passover Seder, you come with these memories from your own Seders and what your own mother, your own grandmother have made.
Totally.
You know,
Noah and Ray talk a lot about that because they took the audacious move to open a deli in New York City and a Montreal sort of style deli at that. So they wrestle all the time with people's memories of delicatessen, people's memories of their parents and grandparents' food, and what they want to do, which is not that. It's elusive to that, or it resonates with that, but it's really something that stands on its own and is about today.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, it's interesting to hear you talk about that memory versus today. And, you know, Passover is a holiday that's all about telling a story and sort of reinterpreting it for you for today. And I'm wondering, when you think about the Passover Seder at the James Beard House, what kind of story do you hope it tells by being there?
Oh, that's a good, very good, interesting question. For me, Seders are a part of memory making and memory reinforcing. I mean, Judaism in general has a lot of stories, and they're not always good ones. And the Passover
right.
story is not always a happy story. You know, I think it's no surprise that most Jewish songs are sung in minor keys. It's a sad history. And so I think we overcome the content, which is a history full of challenge and toil and strife, by creating a feeling of warmth and family and shared experience that sort of is where the joy comes in. And so we have Billy Harris, who is a comedian / borscht belt auctioneer / whatever from LA, is going to be leading the Seder, and we're going to be telling the stories. We're actually using a new Haggadah that the Bronfmans have, Edgar Bronfman Sr. has written, and it's not Seder light, but it isn't Seder heavy either. It's sort of a really nice story. It'd be interesting to see how it all plays out. But I think the shared experience, the Passover Seder is a success at the Beard House if people come back year to year and sort of grow into that experience. We'll see. We can only accommodate 80 people to begin with, so it can't grow that much. But that's what I want people to feel like, is they had a great time and the food was delicious. It isn't all about the food, obviously, because it's a holiday. And as much as in my family we celebrated the food more than anything, I know that we have to accommodate people's sense of what being together for this special night means. And so that, you know, if we create that memory, a joyful experience amidst all of the memories of Passover, I think it'll be a success.
Right. And I'm wondering for you, you know, how does celebrating Passover at the James Beard House, how does that compare to the Seders you had growing up?
I'll be in the kitchen for this one, which is where I often was as a kid, helping in the kitchen. It's a tough question. I grew up really secularly. And I mean, we were a family, I believe we did this with Passover, but we moved all the holidays to the weekends so we could so everyone could get together, because I grew up in Toronto, which is a city with a lot of Jews, but the culture of the city isn't as Jewish as it is here. And so it doesn't stop the way it stops for the holidays here. And I know that's sacrilegious, but we didn't go to temple much. And Passover is obviously a home holiday. So for me, it's sort of about creating new memories. It fuses a bunch of aspects of my life, which is food first and foremost, because of what I do and what I'm obsessed with. And then this sense that I've never not felt incredibly Jewish, but the religious aspect hasn't been a huge piece of it. So to me, Passover is an ideal holiday, because it's about a shared experience in that moment that resonates with this story from long ago of all of the things that have happened. But told sort of in a contemporary way. So it's a new memory, honestly, for me. And I don't know that I could even drag my family to it if they were all here. The new family, our new friends, the people we've met through our different lives, my partner Nate and I, will all be there, and we're gonna start anew. But that will be the challenge. What do we pull out? What new traditions do we invent? Everyone has their own traditions. The one that I've come to late in life as an adult that I hope we engage with is the question asking, the sort of someone tells the story and then someone presents an opinion or tries to contemporize it with something happening. And I've been at several Seders where that's been a part of the service, so to speak. And I think it'd be really great, since we're going to have a room of really diverse people with different backgrounds who don't necessarily know each other, to talk about some things going on. Maybe we'll talk about the Pope, the resignation of the Pope and this unique moment in 600 years of history and what that means for the Jews. I don't know. Maybe we'll talk about snowstorms. Who knows? But it's a bunch of Jews in New York City together over food. They'll be talking, they'll be complaining, they'll be joke telling, there'll be all kinds of stuff. Hopefully it'll be memorable.
Oh, that sounds fantastic. Where would you recommend someone break Passover?
I would recommend you break Passover at a new Jewish bakery in town called Breads, appropriately.
Oh,
which I suspect
that sounds perfect.
They're from Israel, where it's called Lechemim. It's on 16th Street between 5th and Broadway, and I think it's been open 10 days, and I've been in it 20 times. My pants right now are tight because of all the babka and ragolach I've eaten, and I think it might be an appropriate place to break it. I mean, it's the bakery that New York wishes it's had for a long time. Because it's such familiar things, and I've never had a more delicious chocolate babka in my life, honestly. So that would be the first thing I would have.
Oh, that sounds like a perfect ending. Wonderful. Well, thank you so much, Mitchell Davis, for chatting with us a little bit about what to expect this coming Passover at the James Beard House. It sounds delicious, and like you'll be creating lots of new memories. Passover is a Jewish holiday with deep culinary traditions, but it's also a time to experiment and make them your own. We wish you a tasty and a sweet Passover. Chag Sameach.
This piece was produced by Leah Eden and Devra First for HeritageRadioNetwork.org and edited by Jack Inslee. Music provided by Ball of Flame, Shoot Fire, Tech Star, Cookies, Alan Wilkes, and Obesity. Thanks for listening.